As many of you know, NAGAP has an educational curriculum plan that drives the various professional development activities we offer across all of our channels. This includes the Graduate Enrollment Management Summit, which is our annual conference, our summer, winter, and now fall professional development institutes, Perspectives, the NAGAP magazine published 3 times a year, the Exchange Live, our monthly webinar series, and of course this podcast. We strive to expose graduate enrollment management professionals with content across 6 core educational domains that cover the entire graduate enrollment lifecycle. One way we do that is by aligning our offerings to one of these domains each month, covering each area 2 times a year. If you tuned into our recent webinar with Holly Wilbanks of Wilbanks Consulting, you might have had some insight into this month's domain: career, staff, and professional development. Holly's session and the interview you are about to hear are a part of a series of opportunities we are providing to help you consider your own graduate enrollment skill sets and to position yourself well for your next role, either now or in the future. The pandemic has turned the job market on its head, and we know many of our own members have found themselves navigating uncharted territory. The audio for this podcast was supposed to be exclusive to the podcast format, but a last-minute pivot had us shift the conversation to be part of our latest leadership edition of the Exchange Live webinar series. The conversation was held live on February 9th, 2021, and our focus was to discuss the executive search process for enrollment leaders, understand the impacts of the pandemic on these searches, and uncover how graduate enrollment is playing a more significant role in executive hiring decisions.
This is the NAGAP Report, the official podcast of NAGAP, the Association for Graduate Enrollment Management.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us. My name is Marcus Anscombe. I'm the Director of Graduate Admission at Roger Williams University in Bristol, Rhode Island. I'm sure you've seen me a few times on these things. And I'm joined, of course, by my co-host, Keith Ramsdell, who's the Vice President of Enrollment Management and Marketing at Ashland University in Ohio. I know I speak for both of us and certainly the organization that we're excited for today's conversation because we're engaging with Napier Executive Search and certainly great friends and colleagues that we have there. And we're excited to have both Mary Napier and Catherine Capolupo with us. But I want to give you an opportunity to meet Catherine and Mary. So first, I'll have you meet Mary Napier. She's the founder of Napier Executive Search, and they were established in 2014 and focused solely on seeking professionals in the area of enrollment management. And I'm sure for many of you, you've probably seen her on your campuses at some point. I know I certainly have. Mary spent 16 years in college enrollment across 3 institutions, 9 years in the higher education sales space, and 4 years with Lottie Search Consultants before founding Napier Search. And certainly she's been bored, apparently. And then Catherine Capolupo, in full disclosure, was my former boss. So I would say she was smart enough to hire me, so I figured she was smart enough to bring back for a podcast. Catherine joined Napier in October of 2019, and prior to joining Napier, she was VP of Enrollment Management at Roger Williams until I scared her away, and then she went over to Stonehill College in Massachusetts. And as a vice president, she oversaw undergraduate and graduate enrollment, financial aid, marketing, and institutional research. And she began her career in higher education in undergrad admissions on the dark side in what is now Simmons University in Boston. So I want to welcome you both and thank you for your time. We're excited for the conversation. And I want to start first with Mary, just to kind of give a sense for those members that maybe are new to what executive search firms do and maybe what it is specifically that Napier does and how you approach your work. And just give us a sense of, if they engage with a search firm, what does that look like?
Yeah, thanks a lot, Marcus. We appreciate the conversation today. So as you've indicated, our exclusive focus as a search firm is in enrollment management. And so we've got a really deep understanding of that. Oftentimes the colleges and the universities, as well as some companies, will hire us. So it's important for us to have deep knowledge of the network of people. And all our team members have served, like Catherine, and you so eloquently described, have served in enrollment management positions in the past. So we hope that we are asking of the colleges and universities who hire us questions that candidates will ask us as the search firm. So in many ways, we become the intermediary between the two entities, allowing candidates to ask those questions that they might not want to bring up at the beginning of a search. It's at some point in the search, and allowing us to be able to speak with the authentic voice of the institution going forward. So what we hope we do basically is listen well We listen well to the institutions, and we try to listen very well to the individuals who are job seeking so that we can ultimately make a match. And that's what our goal is to place candidates into roles where they're going to be well matched and will flourish on their behalf, but also on behalf of the institutions.
And kind of a part B to that, for those that are new to the kind of the executive search, can you talk about how institutions engage a search firm like Napier at the beginning for a search and what that process looks like?
Sure. It's a variety of ways. Oftentimes it could be an RFP where we're formally responding to an institution's request. Sometimes it comes through referrals from other campuses who have utilized our services well and a word goes out on a listserv and says, who does this work and who does it well? The final way is that they have seen your work personally and say, you're the representatives that we want, because in effect, we become part of the marketing arm of the institution. So there has to be a great deal of trust between the search firm and the institution that's hiring us.
Mary, if I could ask a quick follow-up question on that, because, you know, there are a number of well-known search firms out there, but really yours is one of the few that focuses on enrollment management specifically. And I'm just curious, what motivated you to actually head down that road the way that you have?
Yeah, thanks for asking that, Keith. So I worked with Terry Lottie of Lottie Search Consultants, and that was her model of approach. And Terry and I worked incredibly well together and had similar philosophies and similar values when it came to serving the institutions, but also serving the candidates well. I decided to go in that direction when Terry decided to ramp her business down. There was room in the market for that particular one. Plus, it's what I know. I mean, it's what I know. It's what Catherine knows. It's what our colleagues, Laura and Robin and Tom, know as well.
And Catherine, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about, as you've been working with these searches, the job market obviously has changed. And I'm sure we've seen that anecdotally, but also in very tangible ways. What trends are you seeing in hiring, and what do you foresee as kind of changes in the upcoming year? And I guess I'm going to ask one question on top of that that was asked by one of our registrants. Is one of those things changing in terms of mobility, in terms of being able to have remote work, or what kinds of relocation packages? How is that all influencing the overall hiring process?
Sure. So I think in the past 2 decades, enrollment management has taken on much greater visibility and importance in higher education. We know, driven by economy, changes in demographics, new technology, of course, social media, and our students and families. But this past year required campuses to consider sort of the enrollment management knowledge and skills within their organization in a different way. They needed to look and see what this, they see the need for strong enrollment management leadership, not just at the cabinet level, but throughout all of the enrollment management departments and functions. And I think organizations have recognized that a team of skilled leaders in enrollment management is necessary so that the organization can adapt nimbly to the rapidly changing environment. You know, at the beginning of this pandemic, we did see a pause, I think, reflecting the uncertainty that we all experienced. Colleges and universities really quickly realized and recognized that they needed leadership in enrollment management. It was a priority. It was a necessity. And while they were going through changes on campus related to the pandemic, they saw the need to continue and really put and prioritize searches for executive level leadership in enrollment management. What's changed is how the searches are being conducted. And these changes reflect what graduate enrollment leaders are experiencing. You know, our preliminary interviews are conducted often via Zoom or other platforms. That's become the norm. And many of the organizations are also doing their final interviews in a similar manner. A campus visit might come after a final interview for a finalist. As we're looking forward to the next year, we're seeing that the opportunities will continue to exist for those folks that are ready to step into a director, an AVP or VP role. We see that there's opportunities for people to take a step forward, but also in some instances to take a lateral move into a different type of organization or a different type of responsibilities within the role as well. So it's not just folks stepping into higher level leadership roles, it's people that are also looking at themselves and what they want for their future and taking lateral positions as well. And we see that organizations are very open to that. And I think that's part of what's happened during COVID is just like individuals have taken time to reflect and determine what their values are, institutions have really done the same. And so when they're looking at a hiring process, they've been through sort of a self-reflective process as well, and they're really honing in on what they need as an organization and what is really a priority to move their organization forward, both within enrollment management and more broadly. And so, you know, to give you a couple examples, you know, we're seeing organizations that are saying what we really need is not just the strategy, not just the data, but this type of person as we move forward. One of the things that we're seeing fairly universally is that they want to see individuals in leadership roles that have the skills necessary to innovate and adapt. People that have been able to lead their team through the changes that all of us felt and experienced during COVID. And I think as institutions also are looking at their budgets, there's a greater reliance on tuition as the primary revenue source for institutions. So they're looking at the individual, how is this person going to work with all of us? But they're also prioritizing enrollment management roles because of the revenue source that we bring. So I would say in this next year at the executive level, we're not seeing fewer opportunities. Rather, we're seeing a greater appreciation for the complex skills that are really required to lead admission and enrollment teams during this time. Tell me, what was the second part of your question, Marcus?
Well, it's kind of benefits related, it seemed, because there's, and I'm going to weave in actually another question that came in, is more salary related. Can you speak to any kind of trends you're seeing? Are salaries being cut? Are benefits being cut? Are more remote workers being considered even for these executive roles? What about remote work? Is that something that's just automatically a given now? What kinds of things are you seeing?
I think the remote work, what we're seeing is that organizations have been universally flexible with their employees. I think at the executive level, there is a feeling that folks will need to be on campus to get to know their teams and their organizations. And so I think we'll see how the longevity of remote work lasts in terms of leadership. I expect we're all going to see more flexibility and more different ways of working. But I still think ultimately when they're hiring people at the director, AVP, and executive level, they're looking for someone that whose presence on campus will ultimately be strong for a long period of time. So you're not going to necessarily see someone functioning as a VP living in California and working remotely while they you know fulfill a position in Boston. They may be commuting, but they're not going to be working wholly remote. In terms of salaries, we certainly saw, and we've all heard about this in the news as organizations navigated the salary impact. And so we did see that different organizations were having different dialogues about what compensation looks like at the executive level. Interestingly, they're having those conversations with the push and pull of understanding that to get the candidates that they want, they understand that they still have to pay a fair living wage and something that's appropriate for the role, because frankly, it's still competitive to recruit the best of the best. And these organizations know that it's not just a process of hiring the right person, but oftentimes it is a process of also recruiting the right person that they want that's going to lead them to success.
Right. And we've actually counseled both the hiring parties, namely the presidents or vice presidents, as well as candidates, to have a really open discussion about salaries and the line and where it will go, where it's been. And it no one likes to talk about salary because we all are in higher education because we love to serve the students, true, but you also need to be paid for it. So I think equipping candidates to have that discussion is a big part of what we do as well, as it is equipping the campuses to talk about the full compensation, not just salary, but benefits of living and working on a campus and flexibility, et cetera.
Great. One of the things I would add is that there is one of the things we've seen universally, at least in our searches, is the campuses are also very sensitive to the process that the candidates are going through. They've done a very good job of making sure that candidates had different opportunities to engage with the campus so that they're also making informed decisions on the pathway to taking on a new role, which I think has been really done exceptionally well.
Well, and while we're on that, let me just ask, do you have any recommendations for folks that are pretty much solely looking at, let's say it's a further, you know, remote job that you have to fly to typically, you're not going to drive up the street and see a campus. So you're on Zoom for 100% of your search, 100% of your, how do I feel, you know, about this place? I know that when I came to Roger Williams, I was in the middle of 3 feet of snow and it was dark and feeling like the apocalypse was coming. I was like, how do people live here? Now that I've seen the summer, I know why. But that feeling of being able to experience the campus and talk to folks, how do you recommend that people kind of resolve that in these times where they may or may not have that opportunity?
Campuses have been pretty inventive. I mean, we had one VP who drove around on a golf cart with a selfie stick and a FaceTime and really did the actual campus walk around. And I think just even the willingness to do that signals the kind of collaborative effort that is critical. So that's one thing. Another thing, of course, fortunately, as part of the marketers of the institution, you in graduate and undergraduate admission are responsible for making sure there's lots of video of your location. And if you weren't convinced before, you will be convinced now how necessary that is to really assist your students and therefore assist people who are coming into the role to think about that. So Chamber of Commerce also are a good way to kind of get a feel for the campus or the community that the campuses are located in. And then asking to talk to people who have your hot button issues in mind, whether that's school for children, positions for spouse or partner, those things that will make a difference for you.
Well, and Marcus, if I can also add to this, this was my exact experience. I essentially finished the search process at Ashland and had never stepped foot on campus. And so, you know, I had a follow-up conversation with the president, and he asked me the question, is there anything more you would like to do? And I said, in all honesty, I said, I'm attracted to the campus. I've had, you know, great conversations, but until I step foot on your campus and have some additional discussions with some of the team that I'd be working with face-to-face, you know, I'm very much into the, you know, the body language and the facial expressions, and you can't pick up on those things over a Zoom call. And so fortunately for me, he was very agreeable to that. We arranged a time for me to come out to campus, take a campus tour. He aligned, you know, people's schedules for me to be able to meet with them in small groups. But it was only because of that additional day that I requested that I was able to make the move and accept the position at Ashland.
So let's pivot a little bit, given the search, and you're looking for us now, Mary and Catherine. So, Mary, can you talk about, you know, you pick up the phone, you've identified somebody, maybe you've already kind of pre-qualified them in terms of seeing if they're even interested in a role. What kinds of things are you thinking for when they're on the other side of that Zoom call or the phone call? What types of things can we best position ourselves so that you think when you get off the call, wow, we have to talk to this person further and recommend them to this campus?
Yeah. Oh, gosh, I love that question so much. So what are we listening for? First of all, we're listening for energy and sense of humor. We want to know your whole self, and that means the professional self, the personal self. We will look at your cat, too. We definitely will take a look at that. But actually, we're listening for that, but we're listening for more. We always want to start. We're going to start with degree attainment, positions held. And we want you to be able to give kind of a thumbnail sketch of where you've been professionally. So have that down pat. If you skim any position announcement, so if you're in the job market at all, you'll see that schools expect enrollment management people to practically walk on water. And I mean, there's no doubt about it. Overall, those that are successful bring a couple of things, though. So we're listening for someone who has a really solid understanding of data and what it can tell about the overall chance for the enrollment success of the varying students going through the process. So you need to know how data impacts and prognosticates prospects, leads, applicants, enrolled students. This gets to the heart, in our estimation, of someone's full knowledge and full vision of the field. So we're listening for, is someone strategic and big picture, or are they a well-functioning cog in the wheel and don't necessarily have context? So you want to make sure that you understand that you do more than just look at data, but how you interpret data and how you utilize it going forward. The second thing that is really valued on campuses is collaboration. And so we're listening for examples of how you've partnered clearly on your campus. And so talk about how you've partnered with faculty, how you partnered with deans, other key administrative partners, and the university in general to be successful. You've got to kind of balance that. This is less when you're talking with us, which is more informal, but you do have to balance that sense of what I contributed and how I worked with others to bring this together. And the higher you go on the administrative ladder, the more key it is to drive down what you've done and make sure that you are enhancing what the whole is doing. So being able to walk for that. We're listening for knowledge of technology and systems. How have you worked to bring efficiencies into the process? This is particularly important at the graduate level where you're dispersed everywhere and your processes are dispersed often all over campus, maybe around several campuses. And how do you best serve the institution and the students as a result of that? We listen to, it's important for us, and I think some of this is a personal bias on my part, maybe on Catherine's part too, as former leaders in an enrollment management, we want to hear how your staff has been developed. Mm-hmm. How have you offered, what kind of management style do you bring? And it cannot be, I keep an open door. Please just drop that out of your lexicon. Don't talk about an open door policy unless you go on to give me five things that you mean by that, because everybody in the world has an open door policy, in case you were wondering. And then two other things. We're listening for goal achievement. And so how are you able to articulate what you and your team have accomplished? What results have happened as a result of policies and things that you've put in place? And then finally, and this is not any less or more important than anything else, but what's important to you personally? Are there regions of the country that are intriguing to you? Because we may be speaking with you about a particular opportunity, or Catherine and I may be having a career conversation, which talks about where you'd like to see yourself go. So what's your envisioned next step? What are long-term goals? Who else in your life needs to be considered? That could be spouse, partner, kids, parents. And then we will always ask about compensation expectations as well, and what's important to you from that regard.
There's obviously, you've got exposition in your mind, you're working for a campus to hire somebody, and you're out there and you're identifying a group of folks that meet that. But what about the folks that, kind of to your latter point there, that are thinking, I'm ready for a change, I'm thinking about an executive role, what can that proactive piece be on our part to engaging with you all or another firm for that matter?
Yeah, if honestly, go ahead and speak with us. We're delighted to have that conversation with you. But be honest and share if that position is attractive to you or not. But that's where, back to one of the first things that we spoke about, the fact that we do exclusively enrollment management searches, is that we often have conversations now that we will bank for 10 years. You know, we follow people's careers. We wait till their junior in high school has graduated. We, you know who's going to be empty nesters. And those are all things that can be incredibly helpful along those lines. So,
and Catherine, as you're going through these searches now, are there skills now that, especially post-COVID, that campuses are looking for specifically with executives that may be a little different than they were? I'm sure some of this dovetails with what Mary was just talking about.
Absolutely. I think, you know, there's always been a great deal of importance placed on the ability of enrollment management leaders to build a strategy and to bring that strategy to fruition throughout a campus, right? But now what we're seeing is that it's what's also very important is that teams are able to pivot, to innovate, to execute quickly and really effectively. Mm-hmm. And so the leader of those teams has to be able to rely on their data expertise to know the direction they need to go on. And they've got to read between the lines. They've not only got to be able to look at the data and plan, but also see kind of through the data, seeing the trends, seeing the things that cause you to make a quick pivot. And I think that as we saw with COVID, some schools were very adept at moving online. Some schools were very adept at changing tactics, moving from one type of media to another type of media. And that's because you have people in those leadership roles at the director level, at the AVP level, that are looking at the data and making that pivot very quickly. Part of that is also the ability to navigate and lead at a time of change. So you're leading change and you're managing change within your organization. And so, you know, that is a skill unto itself. You know, the other thing we're seeing is that schools are looking for someone who's, you know, we always talk about communication. Is somebody a good communicator? But I think right now, schools are looking for individuals that have really genuine relationships, not only with students and families, but also they're able to build those genuine relationships across campus. And so that they find an ease in navigating this change because they have those trusting, transparent relationships. So I think that's come to the surface numerous times in recent searches. That communication, regardless of how someone communicates, it's that it's very genuine and transparent. And then I think they're also continuing to look at the long-term challenges. You know, how do we differentiate ourselves in our programs in a noisy marketplace? So they really are going back to some of the basics that graduate enrollment professionals live and breathe is how do you find the market? How do you communicate with that market? How do you start a dialogue? How do you continue to maintain that relationship through different outreach channels? Even on an ongoing basis. I think, just jumping back to also the data issue, one of the things that we're seeing is that schools are not only looking to see that people can do data themselves or manage the data and read the data, but it's also creating a culture of data and sharing it across campus so that not only are you gaining buy-in, but you're actually bringing people into those strategic plans and helping them with the direction you're going in. And I think where some schools have been very nimble, it's because they're able also to communicate the data of why they're doing things very quickly. But it's also because they've already created a culture where it's not just one person looking at data, it's a team of people that is able to look at that. And we know that data, you know, historically, back in the day, we used to do these wonderful summaries of the year in review. And we now know that data is not retrospective or summative. You know, it's the beginning of the conversation. It's the catalyst. And that goes to understanding where you need to place your resources. A big piece of the executive level role is resource management. It's the thoughtful use of outside vendors. It's knowing where to spend your merit dollars in your awards. And it's also know where you're going to spend your marketing dollars and what's been successful. And I think so as we look at how expectations of skills have changed, You know, they're really looking for individuals that have demonstrated success in developing the long-term strategies and developing those genuine relationships, people who are successful in leading change within the organization and have the skills to guide their team and adjust course very quickly and nimbly, and to bring that team with them, or and really bring the entire campus with them when those changes need to take place.
Well, you've both kind of touched on something that I've thought a lot about the past year in particular, because we've got COVID going on. Obviously, everybody's impacted in a lot of different ways and some very significant ways. And it seems like leadership is a little bit more empathetic, for lack of, and I hate to overcharacterize people because there's a lot of very empathetic people. I just don't think that from a hierarchy standpoint, that's been as appreciated as I think this year. It's been more kind of central to what we do. Have you seen any kind of changes in terms of how colleges are approaching kind of the more sensitivity, the more human side of our work, as opposed to just get the numbers, get the production that we need? And in some cases, I've seen institutions, thankfully not mine, but I've seen institutions that are a win at all costs kind of approach. Mm-hmm. Are we seeing a softening of that? I guess, is that a fair question?
Mm-hmm. I think the goals will always be the goals. So sure. I think people want to know that. But there is a great deal of both sympathy and empathy for how do you achieve those goals going forward. And we have seen that very universally among the schools we've been fortunate to serve. And I think it's also made sure that each one of us in our lives has said to others in our lives, it's okay. You know, let's, if we need to slow down for a minute, let's slow down for a minute. Let's figure this out. Let's figure out what we're learning from that process. So I do think that will be one of the silver linings of this period. And I hope we don't lose that going forward. So yes, I think that to answer your question from my perspective, at least, that would be the direction I'd go. Catherine, what else would you add to that?
Yeah, I think there's also been, there's been moments in everybody's experience this past year where institutions have realized that some of the structures that were sort of always in place, you know, that they, with everybody working on campus 100% of the time or things like that, you know, as organizations had to pivot, one of the things they've learned is that they have incredibly hardworking teams that they can trust. Mm-hmm. And I think there's both empathy and sort of a deep appreciation for the fact that their employees have done so well and managed the change and navigated the change and remained as committed, if not more so committed, to the good of the institution. And so I think it's not only just empathy, but I think there's a deep sense of appreciation and trust that many organizations have universally felt about their employees. And employees have felt about one another as well. So I think it goes beyond the empathy. I think there's so many layers there, but I would agree.
And I can't let this go either, because I think it's important, and we constantly are thinking this to ourselves, that it's a two-way street as people are doing a job search. But we've had people come to us and say, you know, I don't like the way my institution administratively has handled the challenges that we're facing right now. It doesn't jive with what's important to me and what's important to perhaps to my family. And so it becomes a crisis of, all right, what are we going to do about that? Do I stay and try to make it better? Or do I look at places that will in fact match up a little bit more carefully? And so that's another thing that you can always do is there's always opportunities to move and change and do something different.
So kind of related then, obviously there's been a lot in the public dialogue this year politically. Of course, COVID has been central, and of course, diversity, equity, and inclusion. And you can't, you know, disregard the fact that obviously it's February, it's Black History Month. We should be honoring, you know, the memories of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and so many others. And I think that's really shifted our mindsets on our campuses, just in how we function as a whole and how we engage with our students and create open and supportive communities. Can you talk about how leaders are being maybe engaged in a different way in terms of their diversity and equity inclusion? Are those skills that you're looking for? Are there specifically things that campuses are asking for, and how are they doing that?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, you know, colleges and universities have long sought enrollment management leaders who have a demonstrated ability to build diverse teams and recruit a diverse student body. You know, the national dialogue has led many institutions to reflect on the work they've done, to authentically consider their campus culture, their hiring practices, their historic ties to slavery, discrimination, and bias, and authentically also consider their treatment of individuals and groups and in the past and today. You know, enrollment management professionals have a responsibility to be part of the campus dialogue, to contribute to positive change on campus, and to provide guidance across the organization, not just within their offices or their division. And I think as schools are looking for enrollment professionals, they want the people that have demonstrated that they not only have the experience, but success in building those diverse teams and diverse student body, but they're looking for individuals who have invested in educating themselves, that are invested in educating their teams, and individuals who are committed to engaging in the dialogue and fostering change, not just within enrollment management offices and divisions, but across campus, and are willing to be part of that broader conversation. So they want to see success, they want to see engagement, and they want to see in these leadership roles, people that are willing to have a presence across campus. Mary, do you have thoughts?
I do. Yeah. I applaud what you just indicated, because what we are absolutely seeing is that an enrollment leader who can speak eloquently and real comfort about areas of student diversity and honoring student differences of all aspects, race, ethnicity, gender identity, sexual orientation, range of ages, backgrounds, and more, someone who can show empathy for the individuals has always been valued, but that goes even further today. All enrollment management leaders, every single person who's aspiring to a leadership role needs to be able to talk about issues of diversity, about equity, and about inclusion, and understand the differences between the three. We've seen committees asking point blank questions about candidates' successful initiatives in diversity recruitment. And the people who've made a marked impact on the committees are people who have been actively involved in the work and who have been actively involved in the conversation. So they're the ones who resonate, can demonstrate evidence of inclusion. And not just diversity, but inclusion. And that means a commitment to the success of all students in higher education. So if you're not comfortable in that language, you need to be comfortable. You need to become comfortable in what that means, because what's at stake is the students themselves and how you're best able to represent them, how you're best able to work with them and their families.
One thing, of course, you spoke to in that was regarding to ages of students, and that's obviously central to our work in the grad side, because on one hand, I've got a 21-year-old for a program, and then I've got a 65-year-old for the program, and, you know, to market and support and recruit and all of the things that we need to do for those various age groups, obviously, it's very different, and many of us are on campuses that are dominated by an undergraduate conversation. I know mine certainly is. And we know that the kind of cliff that's planned or thinking about 2025 that we know from a data perspective is coming, and many campuses thankfully were planning and others not so much. But know that grad and non-traditional and continuing ed, whatever other buckets are going to become more important. Can you maybe speak to what the demand is like on these jobs that you're hiring for, and how grad is maybe shifting more into that conversation? Is it becoming, I mean, we think anecdotally it is, but we always predicted that, I suppose, on the grad side, but are we seeing that? Is that actually coming to fruition, knowing that there's market factors that are going to really hurt the undergrad population?
You know, to address the impending cliff and the changing perception, you know, all of those are real. And so it's like, we'll get more graduate students. Ooh, that's the answer. We do think that it's critical for the enrollment management leader to have the right seat at the table and in a and enrollment management will continue to evolve out of the shadows into the strategic thick of things. So we also hope that there's a move toward utilizing, and we kind of pointed to this earlier, but to understanding who you're recruiting and to whom you are recruiting. So really understanding in almost a pipeline approach how the students that you are reaching out to, whether it's at the graduate or undergraduate level, are being impacted in a positive way. So we anticipate knowing that an institution and a community can inform the direction that an institution is going to go. And the interesting thing is that community can be anywhere with online or hybrid delivery, but it's also a matter of knowing your brand's portability and how to influence that, that will factor in as well. And I think that grad work has been really deeply implanted in that always, that it is about the brand of the program, it's the brand of the faculty, it's the brand of the understanding of the product of education. And so I do think that's creeping into, in a positive way, creeping into how enrollment management is handled today.
We've fortunately, we just hired a new president and also a new provost on our campus. And as part of their searches, grad was actually listed as one of the five strategic pillars for both of their positions, which I was very thankful for because we weren't anticipating, but we also were looking forward and saw that that was necessary. Are you finding that campuses are coming to you and thinking undergrad roles in particular, like VPs of enrollment, especially at smaller schools that traditionally were so undergraduate focused, are you finding that these campuses are coming to you and saying, we need to hire for this person, but grad needs to be a bigger slice of the pie, or they need to have different skill sets for that? Are you hearing that? And how's that kind of infusing differently than it was, say, 5 or 10 years ago?
You know, it's interesting because I think as some of the organizations are entering graduate, starting with graduate programs, they know that they don't know everything, and they certainly are looking for the expertise in understanding how to access, you know, that entire marketplace of graduate students. And so even if they're looking for a very traditional VP for enrollment management at an institution that's very currently undergraduate focused, they see the need to bring someone in who has that experience that they have not had historically on their campus. Someone who knows how to partner with faculty and other administrators in bringing programs to the marketplace that are going to succeed, not just because the data shows that we need more of these in the marketplace, but we also know how to shape the curriculum, the programs, the delivery, the pacing, all of those things that can add or subtract to the success of a graduate program. So they are looking for those people. And I think they're also understanding, even if they have a history of successful graduate programs, they're looking for people who really understand how to identify and reach that target audience that Mary was talking about, that the folks that really understand the differences in markets for different graduate programs. And quite frankly, there's an appetite for bringing that skill set that graduate folks have of understanding the difference between the market for, say, a master's program in education through a master's program in computer science, and really how to hone in and reach those different folks. There actually, there's an appreciation for bringing that to the undergraduate level as schools really try to reach even traditional age students and bring in students for majors that they want to promote, where they want to expand, or whether they want to fill empty seats in a major, whatever the case may be. And so there is an appreciation for the skills that I think are fairly unique to graduate program administration, enrollment management. And, you know, there's something else here that I think there's an appreciation for as you look at people in leadership roles and enrollment management, is that graduate folks have had greater direct exposure to the accreditation process. They've worked really closely with the faculty all along. They've worked with program directors, multiple program directors, and then they tend to work very closely with folks that are working on the accreditation process. So they also have a better understanding of the accountability that the accrediting bodies have for the graduate programs. And then, therefore, they're a little bit closer to the direction the program needs to go. And not only what the institution wants for the program, but what the accrediting body wants for the programs. And so, you know, I think that is also valued when you go into the process of hiring a VP or AVP, someone who understands how that accrediting process not only works, but how to live through that process from the writing of the documents to understanding how accreditation influences strategy as well.
I was just going to, as a follow-up question, and either Catherine or Mary can address this. You know, I think you bring up some very good points, Catherine, about the desirable skills of the GEM professional, and I have certainly experienced that and seen that as well. But one of the challenges that I think happens is that there's almost a disconnect. Like, this person has worked in graduate enrollment for X number of years. They're disconnected from things, in particular, undergraduate financial aid and merit-based aid. That was a huge gap for me in that dialogue. So I guess the question that I have is, we've seen very few graduate, enrollment management professionals out of NAGAP move into a VP level position. What, in your opinions, could be something that, and certainly as an association, we want to be a part of that, just like we're presenting this here today. What can we do to help provide the training and encouragement that would help members of NAGAP move in that direction? What gaps do you see that we can help kind of fill?
Some of it is the gap of how you explain the role that you've played. If there really is a gap, if you really haven't had exposure to things that are going to drive the enrollment, the undergraduate enrollment, like financial aid leveraging or marketing that is for a much more narrow group of students, then it's important to get exposure in that area. And once you have exposure, make sure that people don't allow you to put you in that bucket, so that you're hitting it head on in both your cover letter and in conversations, if you're afforded the opportunity, conversations with committees, is my immediate reaction to that.
You know, and I think the other thing is that sometimes folks haven't had the exposure in sort of the broader sense, or they've had exposure but not responsibility. So maybe merit awards are done by the faculty for the program somebody works with. Even asking to be part of the conversation and be part of the process, I think, is, it can be important. Sometimes you're not trying to, maybe you're not going to take over that process, but just being at the seat to hear how it's done. And then sometimes taking the role of offering some insights. Similarly, working with the undergraduate folks to ask to participate in some things where there's a sharing of resources and ideas, because certainly undergrad can learn some things from how an awarding process is done at, say, a law school or a MBA school or whatever it is, and grad folks can learn from undergrad. I think also, too, is sometimes there's a lot of focus on a strategic enrollment plan that is undergrad. And so it's sort of sometimes treated as an afterthought. And so I think, and sometimes it's not authored by the graduate enrollment folks who really know what's going on in the marketplace. Sometimes it is necessary to design your own strategy and bring it forward, or raise your hand to be the author, so that you're gaining that valuable experience and you're living through that process, so it becomes part of your portfolio, because sometimes it's handed to you. And in fact, I spoke with one person who was saying that her school has a great strategic enrollment plan for undergrad, and there is not one for the graduate programs. And I said, well, here's your opportunity to write one for your own program. And they also had a lot of committee structures around the undergraduate programs. And there was no enrollment committee for the graduate programs. And to which I said, well, call together a meeting. I said, bring the other graduate program directors together and you can start the dialogue and you'll be happy you did. And so sometimes it's just that the structures are different or they have not had as much visibility. And sometimes I'll be honest with you, graduate enrollment folks are so efficient at catching somebody in the hallway and navigating those relationships with different faculty members that it's not always a necessity or seen as a necessity to pull everybody together for a formal meeting because of the efficiency and the relationships that people have built. And so it's kind of bringing that those successes together and those people together to sort of formalize the structures, because the structures will be needed eventually.
How do you recommend place-bound or dual career candidates navigate their career planning? This is obviously an issue for a lot of us, especially folks that have a lot of commitments at home. So what suggestions do you have?
It starts with honest discussions at home. I mean, that's, you have to have those give and take conversations about what is realistic in order to be able to make a move and what that looks like. And then sharing those realistic parameters, using those parameters in a realistic fashion as you're creating your job search. So, you know, if in reality your partnership is something that you prize and that means that you stay in Massachusetts, not looking for a job in California because it's never going to end well, but knowing that there may be some areas that could be intriguing or open that you'd be open to thinking about, and then being honest about how that might be approached is my immediate reaction to that.
When we're talking to folks, whether we're having a career conversation, which is, you know, someone who's ready for a transition and wants to talk about what that transition might look like, that's one of the first things we're going to ask is, you know, what are your parameters so that we're not, frankly, reaching out to you with an opportunity in California, but we're reaching out with an appropriate opportunity. And it helps us, you know, it sort of helps us understand what your priorities are. But it also is, as Mary was saying, that starts with a conversation at home so people know what their priorities are. And I, you know, expect that people in the past year have gotten a fairly clear sense of what's important to them. But sometimes having that conversation to list those out doesn't always happen with your partner or with consideration to when you really could move and things like that. So it's always good to start that way.
And I know another pressing question that we've gotten, there were some themes of this with Holly's conversation last week. What about folks that are having to start over? In the midst of COVID, some people have been laid off or they've been reduced in some way, and they're just looking at kind of starting behind, and maybe they're 20, 30 years in, and now all of a sudden you're starting at ground zero. Maybe you had a director level position and now looking for a new job. I mean, are these gaps looked at in a negative way? How can people address a layoff and trying to get a job that maybe is at or above the level that they were already at? This kind of restart seems to be creating a lot of anxiety for people.
You can't change your experience, and you can't change if a position that you were in was eliminated. You can't do that. So all you can do is keep going forward. And so making an honest assessment of what's important to you makes sense. And also, I think in much the same way that we talked a little bit about how important it is to not have a specific, that you must go from point A to point B to point C, to always in a linear fashion. There's no such thing in reality. It's what suits you and what suits opportunities that are availing themselves to you. I mean, I think in this COVID time, if you leave a position or are asked to leave a position due to the position being eliminated, you've got in some ways a perfect cover for going forward, and that can work out in your behalf. It can work in your favor. So that's where I would think I would start, is just with that honest understanding of nobody gets to write my narrative but me. So let's do this and let's make sure that we own that going forward.
Well, one theme that came up with Holly last week too that's related to this is, I think, and I admittedly I've felt this myself at times, we get so into our lane, right? Our graduate admissions lane or our graduate enrollment lane, that we have this tendency to think that, well, my skills aren't good anywhere else. I mean, I've had families say, why don't you go work the public sector? You make twice as much money. I mean, I don't want to do that. But there, it's hard to get my mind around I have things to offer to that other job. And even in the context of our institutions, can you speak to kind of the transferability of the enrollment manager's skills in these various roles that may or may not be that exact, you know, level role that they already had?
You know, there's a, I think that is one thing, is we do get focused on where we think we are. And when you look at transferable skills, you will find that many organizations are looking for similar things at the surface. And then there's some very tactical skills they need within roles. And, you know, as people look at different positions, I suggest that they map it back to their own resume. Yeah. And in fact, I sometimes think that so graduate enrollment management professionals don't give themselves quite enough credit. So when you're looking at what should be on your resume, I always suggest people look at their calendar, because there's a whole lot there that I bet you forgot that you did and achieved in the course of a year. But it's mapping those skills, and then it's articulating that those skills map sometimes. But there are certainly many organizations that are looking for graduate enrollment people and enrollment management people in general to move over, where they see the transferable skills. And some of them are your vendors. Obviously, we all know about people that have moved to the vendor side of the house. Mm-hmm. But there's also other nonprofit agencies, organizations, and then there's private business. And it's, you know, doing that mapping can be, it can be very affirming about what your abilities really are. And take a job description and think critically, have I done this and can I do this? And by the way, and do I want to do that as my job? That sometimes is the biggest question, not whether you are able to do it, but whether you are willing to do it.
Right, Catherine. And a good way to map it is informational interviews too. So, you know, to those great relatives who give you that advice, say, you know, do you know someone that you could introduce me to at this job? And then do 1,000 questions to that person. What is it you do on an everyday basis? And that kind of thing. The cover letter that you write coming out of an informational interview can help you boom, 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 identify all the skills and abilities that you have within that field, as Catherine says, if you want to do it.
Well, and then we had one other question from an attendee that I thought really weaves well into all of this. If you have somebody that's thinking about that executive level position, whether it be AVP or VP or so on, how should they think about retooling? I think Holly called it like a brand, like your own personal brand toolkit or something like that. And I'll apologize to Holly for calling it the wrong thing, but positioning the resume and the portfolio of things that we have to be presentable, to be the best representation of ourselves in an executive way, as opposed to a traditional, more mid-level role.
One of the things we hit on earlier, which is that the delineation between we and I, and knowing when to bring that up, knowing that both collaboration and communication are going to be at the heart of every executive position that's there, is to be able to very quickly be able to identify what you've done successfully and the part you've played in it and the part you've empowered others to play in that, and how going forward you would increase or decrease both. The one that makes the most amount of sense is the very first thing that comes to mind when I think about retooling and really prepping yourself for that executive level. I mean, we've got a good example. Keith's on the line here of somebody who's moved from into a more executive administrative role, right? I'm going to throw it to Keith.
And I think, you know, for myself, I'm fortunate that I've got a team around me, and I spent a lot of time doing, you know, and I think you and I had talked about this at some point, the networking, the asking of questions. You know, I spent a couple of years at Bowling Green State University, and the last couple of years I was there really thinking about, if I want to do this, what do I need to do to prepare myself? Who do I need to ask questions of? You know, I've got a couple mentors who have made similar moves in their careers. And so I spent, you know, and I still spend quite a bit of time with them, because there are gaps in my knowledge base, honestly. And so I need to continue to, train myself literally on a daily basis and make sure that I'm up to speed, because that's the expectation that my university and my president have. And so that's my responsibility.
And, you know, the other part of this is that when someone takes on their first VP role, oftentimes they're taking on something they haven't done in the past. You know, I always say you probably have 80%, but you're never going to have 100. Know that institutions are also looking at the individuals that they're hiring and prioritizing what they need. Some institutions will say to us, I need someone who is a slam dunk with financial aid leveraging. And other institutions will say, hey, we've got a great AVP who can take care of that. What I really need is someone who really understands marketing. And so within enrollment management roles, they are not uniform. They're unique, just like you are. And it's finding the match where you may not have had as much experience. Maybe they already have that success on their campus or someone really strong in that role. So that's where, frankly, where the work Mary and I do that helps us make that match sometimes. And the campuses are also looking at that. But there is definitely sort of that growth mindset that's required when stepping in to realize you're not going to know everything, and it's you will have to train yourself. And sometimes that's signing up for webinars or whatever it is.
Well, I'll wrap this with one kind of final question, because I'm seeing some of the chat here. I know Mary responded to one of our attendees. Can you just talk about obviously our folks are looking for a certain role. Maybe it's the right fit for their families, or the right fit for financial, of course, and right fit for the type of school, maybe what kinds of, you know, support they're going to have about the passion of the type of place they're at and so on. So there's some transparency that's necessary on our side to say what we need and what we want and what's critical and what isn't. And then there was a question related to the institution side of kind of what transparency comes down through the institution to the executive search, and ultimately then to us that are searching, and making sure that we're transparent through that process so that, and in the case of this particular question, occasionally, we're not always set up to succeed. Maybe they don't have that team that Catherine was just talking about built around you to support you. Maybe things are crumbling underneath the hood, but they're not very open about that. We hope that that's not necessarily the case. But can you just talk to kind of that transparency piece? What kind of transparency are you getting from organizations, and how does that get relayed to an applicant? And ultimately, what are you expecting from us?
I think I've used the word honesty a lot, and I think that you have to both be honest and trust in the process. But when we are working with an institution and they are asking for someone who can truly walk on water, which is not possible, we try to educate them to what is realistic. We also hope that candidates in their discussion and conversation as they're talking with them will both engage in good questions and bring that same speaking truth to power. Because the coin of the realm that we're all in is education. And so we owe it to the institutions we serve to educate them better. You as candidates owe that to the institutions that you may be applying to, and certainly the institutions owe you that as well. So it really needs to be, people need to be discerning. They need to be paying attention to data, IPEDS data, information that's readily available, and also information that if it's putting alarm bells off in your head, trust that. And one thing we will always do is level with you about the situation and the position and say that's a part that is difficult from what we have assessed. And we owe you that to make sure that we're completely honest with you about that process.
Well, I think the moral of the story is you can lead us to water, but we have to be able to walk on our own a little
bit. Absolutely. Ask those questions, Marcus. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, thank you both. This is a fantastic conversation. Of course, thank you, Keith, for co-hosting as usual. But Mary and Catherine, really appreciate all your insights and your collaboration, of course, your friendship as always. And I look forward to engaging with you all in the future. And of course, thanks for our attendees for coming. Hope this was helpful. And we look forward to seeing you in a future session.
Thanks so much
for having us.